This is Colin Scott from E&J Scott Orchards from Buckland, Massachusetts, and you're listening to Cider Chat.
Episode number 93. Hello, and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Aria Wincaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. And this week, we are speaking with Colin Scott of E.J. Orchards in Buckland, Massachusetts. There'll be more on that chat in just a moment. Well, hello, Ciderville. I hope you've had a wonderful weekend in between last week's episode and this week. Last week, by the way, episode 92 was with Brad Glover of Swilled Dog Hard Cider in West Virginia. That was a lot of fun, meeting up with the first cider maker down in West Virginia, so you might want to check that out. And this week, we're going to be back in my spot of Ciderville, speaking with a local orchardist. I think that's going to be really exciting. I'm going to get to that in just a moment. It's been a little bit of a long weekend for me. I am sad to say it was absolutely beautiful outside, but I was inside kind of taking care of my head. I have this kind of weird thing that's going to make this recording a little interesting for me. Because one of my ears are blocked. I've never had this kind of sinus thing before, and I'm just taking it in, well, I don't want to say totally in stride, because being sick is never fun. So if you're out there and you're in bed or just feeling a little blue in one way, this episode is going out to all those folks who kind of need that little pickup, because I certainly felt that, and it's not a pleasant feeling. Yeah, a little bit of a blocked ear, which makes me a little bit lopsided. Never been like this, but what I am considering it is that, you know, as you kind of take on these different colds and viruses that come through, you're just building your immune system, right? I think being in Ciderville is always looking on the bright side of life, because it's tough work. You know, I had plans to get out and do a lot of picking and going out and checking out different apples and pear trees that I'm hoping to press, and time is kind of running out for me. I'll get to that in a moment, but it didn't happen. I just couldn't do it. Sometimes life stops you, and if you are a commercial maker or your orchardist or anyone in the trade, that could really throw you back, can it? So it's hard work, and I think that's probably speaks to the person that we're going to have on this week's chat. Colin is a full-out orchardist and was raised, you know, essentially doing this his entire life. So I think you're going to hear that there too. Anyways, I'm slowly coming on the other side of that awful experience, but you might hear it a little bit in my voice. And as such, I'm not going to belabor it too much. But I want to say that despite all that, I got the most amazing little bit of contact all in one day. I think this was on Sunday or Saturday. I can't remember now because my whole world was kind of turned upside down. But I heard from three different parts of Ciderville from around the world. So that just shows you the reach that we have and how Ciderville is everywhere. Anywhere where there are palms, that is Ciderville, and that's the beauty of it, and the excitement that you could feel from everybody having connection. I spoke about a new patron about 2 weeks or so, Greg, out in the LA area, saying that Cider Chat really felt like a touchstone, and man, if this doesn't like kind of seal that deal, just check it out. First, I heard from Joe, who was on Saturday, which was the 26th of August, and he posted on the Cider Chat Facebook page a really cool, like, 360 view of the cider circus at Copper Mountain in Colorado. Now, if you recall, you've been a regular listener, you'll know that there was a big ticket giveaway, two sets of tickets, I should say, to that event a while ago for anybody who just kind of signed up for the eCider News at the ciderchat.com page. And Joe was one of the lucky winners, and he was kind enough to post a photo so we could all see what was going on. So you might want to take a look at that. So that was coming out of Colorado in the US of A. Then I heard via Instagram from Whose Cider You On? And that chap was, well, basically first sent me a direct video. And there's this new thing on Instagram. You could send a video or and it you can only watch it twice and then it's gone. So I didn't know that. So I watched it twice and I was excited to kind of share it to my family and it was gone. But that's okay. The photo was taken in Copenhagen at a cider festival. And it was of Jeppe Gentz, who was on episode number 71. And the festival was Riggetig Cider. And Whose Cider You On was there. And Jeppe was holding up a couple of bottles and thanking me for recording the podcast. Now, I don't know if Whose Cider You On knew about Jeppe before going to this event in Denmark. But how cool is that? They connected. He probably noticed the cider. And then he posted another nice photo of Jeppe, too, via his Instagram feed. So you might want to check that out at Whose Cider You On, who does a lot of nice postings from around the world. And unfortunately, for the most part, if you are on this side of the world, you have a hard time finding Feho cider. This is Oh, there's Boy Cat trying to come in again. Hang on, Boy Cat. All right, I got to go, Boy Cat. I'll be right back.
Come on, buddy.
Okay, I'm back. You know, I would have had one of the palms help me out, one of the talking palms, but as you might have noticed, they haven't been around lately because they're out in the orchard doing what they do best, which is getting ready and ripe for this fall's harvest. So I'm kind of just alone, and me and my lonesome just kind of managing things around the cider house right now until all that happens. Anyways, the only place that you could get Feho cider in the U.S. is if you're in New York City, which, you know, a lot of people do pass through there, and you're arriving at Grand Central Station, and there's a large food court, and if you go to the food stand, or you know, obviously this is an amazing little stand called Great Northern Food. So there should be a link to that on the show notes for the episode number 71. So that was cool. So we had Colorado, Denmark, and then we had Japan. Yeah, I mean, boing, that's around the world. And from Japan, I heard from Lee Reeve, who is with the World Cider Experience. Now, this is a new group that's just been started, and it's all about promoting cider and cider education in Japan. And Lee is working with a fellow by the name of Clive Poole, who is the publican of the Full Monty British Pub and Cider Bar. Now, that's pretty neat, isn't it? And there's going to be a new magazine coming out of Japan called Insider Japan. And they're hoping to publish their first issue in November. And then they're planning a big event in the spring, a Cider Fest. That's going to be in Japan. So that's just wonderful news. So we'll be keeping tabs on that, and I suspect we'll be speaking to Lee in the not-so-distant future. So, yep, cider is around the world, and that is one more note on how cider is going up. Before we begin this chat with a Colin Scott, I'd like to give you a little bit of background on how we met. It all took place on the day that I arrived to bid on the cider press at an auction. Now, if you haven't listened to that chat, you want to go to episode number 86, and I'll give you the whole history on the cider press. As I was pulling up to the site, I noticed right across the street were a whole bunch of apple trees, and they were in buckets, and I figured they were for sale, so you knew I was going to make it one way or another over to that side of the road. And when I did, that's when I was able to meet both Colin and Laura Scott. And Colin is a longtime orchardist. He grew up in the orchard, well, so to speak, I imagine. His dad and his mom started the Scott Orchard, and he just naturally took over. And his dad has since passed. Well, he'll be speaking a little bit on that. You know, it really piqued my interest to meet him. And the interesting thing about colon that I didn't know. And you know, this is a little bit of what I'm hoping that Cider Chat is doing. And obviously, as I mentioned earlier, it is kind of connecting the dots around the world. The thing is that colon is right smack in kind of the middle of the region where Cider Days takes place. That's going to be coming up the first weekend of November in Massachusetts. And he's never really attended anything at Cider Days. You know, a lot of his orchard is essentially culinary apples, though he is now planting some cider apples, and he has some nice cider varieties that he sells. Every year at Cider Days, Lou and Sue Chadwick, who are on episode 76, they were talking about doing rind grafts, if you recall. They actually have a lot of the apple trees that Colin has prepared for folks to essentially buy and take away. And every year they sell out. So there's going to be some info if you want to contact Colin directly and you're coming into the region and you want to take some apple trees home. He would be a good direct connect to get with. This guy has been in it from the beginning. And I think that sets him apart a little bit from a lot of the folks that we've had on the podcast. A lot of folks are coming into cider making later in their life. They're starting to become orchardists. They may have taken things on one way or the other, but they haven't been essentially brought up in the orchard. Certainly, we've had those folks too. I mean, Tom Oliver's farm. We didn't really get into that, you know, in Hereford in the UK. And that's a family farm, of course. But this particular chap is a little bit different, and I think you'll hear that in the conversation too. So I thought this would be an interesting perspective to have that might be a little bit different than some of the new orchard-based cideries coming up, because he's been doing it his whole time. And he's going to be talking about rootstock that he found really is, well, a little bit more, not tenacious, but a little bit stronger to deal with some of the different problems that can happen when you're grafting onto trees and some of the little buggers out there like fire blight and things like that. So it was a very interesting conversation for me, a real joy to get to meet him and to create this relationship with somebody who I kind of consider on the other side of the river from where I live, but oh so close too. So why don't we all now grab a glass and join this chat and head out to speak with Colin Scott of EJ Scott Orchard in Buckland, Massachusetts. And in this chat, you're going to notice that we're going to begin right in one of the apple storage rooms that he has at his site. These are vast rooms, and we'll be talking all about it. Again, we're going to be talking about orchard care, but also apple storage, which I think is something that a lot of folks don't realize what is involved there. It's not just grabbing the apples and then you press them and no problem. I mean, some of these scenes around the world are, there's warehouses filled with apples, and it's not just you put it in there and forget about it. There's a lot of management. So we're going to be talking about that aspect. And it really opened me up to a world that I didn't understand, because as you well know, I'm on this voyage as you are too. Some of you out there might know all that there is to know about it, but I have a feeling that a lot of folks don't really understand what is fully involved in the full cycle of an apple from the rootstock, picking it, storing it, pressing it, and getting it into the bottle and bringing it to consumers like you and I. So that's where we're going to begin. And then eventually we'll get to where we're sitting down and talking about it. I hope you enjoy this chat as much as I do.
We have, it's actually 20,000 bushel capacity.
20,000 bushels,
three
wow.
Separate rooms, all refrigerated. Each of these rooms hold right around 4,000 bushel apiece. I mean, excuse me, 8,000 bushel apiece. The back room is 4,000. So it's 20 if we jam it full. But we like to have a little elbow room, so probably 17 is easier on us.
Wow. So I just want to let the folks in Siderville know where we're standing right now. Colin and I are in this, like, it's like a concrete box, essentially.
Actually, that's what it is. Yeah, it's cinder block walls.
Okay.
It's got sprayed on urethane insulation. It's 2 inches on the outside wall and 1 inch on the inside. It's got an R value of 17.
Wow.
And the other room over here.
Oh, hang on a second, though. What is the dimension of this room?
Oh, you know, I don't even know.
Well, I'm looking at those. What are those?
Those
apple?
Are 15 bushel bins right there.
And you could stack them?
Seven high.
Seven high.
Yeah, seven high, and they'll go, I've got to count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 wide.
Okay.
And they're probably, when we get done, if it's full, it's right to the door here.
Wow, holy cazoli.
We've had years, bumper crop around where all three rooms are just packed right to the door.
Now, I'm going to guesstimate that height-wise, we're looking at 25 feet?
I would say close to it, yeah.
Okay, and then width rise is about 30?
Yeah, 30, probably closer to 40.
30, 40, and then this is 50?
50, yeah.
Okay, all right, so a nice warm, or not warm, but cool kind of room for storing your apples.
We actually can keep it within a degree. I try to run it at 32 and a half. The compressors will turn on at 32 and a half and run it down to 31 and a half.
Wow.
And a degree makes a lot of difference in storage keeping, you know, the life of the apple.
Can you say more about that?
Well, there's several things you fight in apples ripening. One is temperature. One is ethylene production, that the apple naturally puts off ethylene gas, which is one of the things I like to do is purge the room as often as I can and get rid of that ethylene gas. I put a fan in the door, blow it out, get fresh air in here. You try the best you can. Of course, there's smart freshing now, which is
Smart Freshing.
Smart Fresh is the name of the product and what they call it. And what it does is it takes one of the elements out of ethylene production. And I'm not chemist enough to tell you what it is. I've seen the diagram, but if you look it up, you can find it.
Okay.
And what that supposedly does, when everything works right, is it stops the apple from producing ethylene, which turns starches to sugar, which ripens the apple.
So it stops the ripening process.
Yes. By gassing the room, and it's a gas they put in here.
Uh-huh.
We don't do it, but a lot of the guys are using it. They can actually hold the apple for, I've heard, putting them in CA for up to years.
Whoa. Now, you know, that all sounds good in the chemist's world, and I'm sure chemists figures it out, and they're like, "Wee!"
Yeah.
But in my mind, as a person who really likes a fresh-tasting apple and a certain vitality of like a natural aging process, I wonder, you know, is a consumer so dumbed down that they don't notice? I don't mean that in a mean way, but maybe I kind of do, speaking to a lot of people. Like, we just don't know what we're getting anymore because the quality is so crappy.
Well, I think that's a lot of the food production in the world. It's become very scientific. It's not like...
And the bottom dollar, too.
Exactly.
The bottom dollar. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
Everything from genetically altered corn to bananas,
GMOs.
And I guess, you know, we've become used to seeing fresh fruit on the store shelf year-round.
It's true.
It wasn't too many years ago before they started shipping it in from the southern hemisphere that you had it as long as you could keep it in storage here in the north.
Wow, isn't that something?
Yeah.
So how long are you keeping your apples in here?
Well, so this room is a regular storage. The back room is a short-term one. This is a little longer-term. And then over in this next room is actually a controlled atmosphere room. And what we do here is we're able to remove the oxygen out of the room.
All right.
So we're technically putting the apples to sleep. Well, it is. We run the oxygen around 3 and the carbon around 4. And it puts them in a coma.
So what does that mean?
Okay.
Putting them to sleep. But
it's by not allowing them to have the oxygen, they can't go through that process of ripening.
Okay.
So it's a very delicate, too little oxygen, you end up with dead flesh on the apples. Too much oxygen, they ripen. But if you hold it right there, 3 and 4, that's, I mean, the guys push the limits both ways, trying to, you keep them longer and everything, but those are good, safe, and you're just not allowing the apple to ripen.
And so with that in mind, what is your goal here for this room? You're putting them to sleep and not letting them ripen.
So that gives you a longer sales time.
Okay.
So you can load the back room. You know that you've got to have those out by Christmas. This room over here will last until February. This one, we packed as late as July out of this one. And the apples were still crisp.
Crisp, nice.
I will not say that they have the flavor of a fresh picked apple, but...
Appreciate your honesty in that.
Yeah. I mean, but they are a good crisp apple when you take them out.
Yeah. So, I mean, food preservation, it's all part of it, whether you're pulling out that chemical property or you're coating it with or sucking out the oxygen.
Yep.
It's the end goal.
Is to keep the fruit as long as you can. It's no different than a crisper drawer in your refrigerator.
Right.
You know, these frost-free refrigerators just suck the moisture right out of fruit.
That's
so they make a special drawer that keeps the moisture in.
Yeah.
But there again, you run into, if you try to keep apples in them very long, you end up with a buildup of ethylene. So people who keep them in those crisper drawers ought to take them out once in a while, just let them air, put them back in, you'll get a lot more life out of them.
Good tip for the refrigerator. Yeah. Interesting. So this is about the same size room, a little bit smaller.
No, they're exactly the same.
Oh, they are exactly? Okay, got it. It's like the optical illusion.
Yeah, it is, because we're standing on the other side of it, I guess.
Yeah.
So actually, it's the same thing here, only it's got a double floor on it. There's a concrete floor poured with ethylene and then another concrete floor on top to make the airtight seal.
A concrete floor and then ethylene?
The sprayed on urethane.
Sprayed on urethane. Okay.
And then another floor. Everything's airtight in here when we seal it up.
Wow.
The doors are sealed. So I let whatever oxygen in we want and keep it at...
So what is the temperature that you do keep it at?
That we run a little warmer. It's around 36.
So, was I right? 31?
32 over
32
there is what
room.
I aim
okay.
for. Once I break the seal on this and let oxygen, I drop the temperature right down to 32 on this one, too.
Mm. Wow. Well, a lot of people now making cider, you know, either they're kind of stuck doing it right then when the apples are all ready to come in, which is kind of ideal, but folks who are really doing higher production, they want to be able to do that all year round.
Right.
And so this is one of the ways, there are two different options to do it, really.
Yeah. Actually, I don't know whether you ever met the fellow who owns Artifact Cider. He actually would like Dave Shearer to run a CA room just for cider apples so that he can press into the summer and keep a steady supply coming all the way through.
Because that's where he's getting it.
That's where, yeah.
A CA room.
That's controlled atmosphere. That's what
controlled
this room
atmosphere.
Is.
Controlled atmosphere, CA,
yeah.
I love
so
it.
So there's different ways, and a lot of the guys are using both the Smart Fresh and the CA. And I don't think we really know how long you can keep an apple by doing both of them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Nice. Now, again, we're standing in this identical room here, and I'm... There's a lot of boxes here, and then I'm seeing around the corner there, I'm seeing a little press.
A little cider press, yeah.
Yeah, and...
It's one of the bladder presses that Orchard Equipment sells down in Conway.
Yep.
We had a big...
Orchard Equipment, that's...
Osco.
Osco, yeah. Yeah, they're a big supplier. They ship around the world.
Right. A funny story, the reason they're in Conway, they were in Connecticut, and my mom and dad bought one of their first cider presses.
Whoa.
Went and got it and brought it up, and a couple weeks later, the Frenches drove up to see how it was running, and when they went by that building, and they said, what's going on there? So dad and mom took them down to the town of Conway, and they ended up buying it.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a great story.
Wow.
I love that.
Yeah.
So how do you like the bladder press? And this looks like, in many ways, it's like... you know, like a barrel press, but you're calling it a bladder press because it's...
Right.
I'm going to just describe it to folks.
Okay.
So this is... It's on wheels. It's all stainless steel.
Yep.
It has a nice circular stainless steel tray that a vertical, you know, basket, of course, sits on. And it has horizontal slits all the way around. I'll get a photo of this. So
this is for the juice to come out, and
yep.
Truthfully, I've yet to use it. This
Ooh.
Is going to be the first year we've gone from rack and cloth to this.
Oh, changing out of rack and cloth to this.
Yep.
That's kind of interesting.
So this is the bladder sets in here. You fill it up, and then you fill water, and it pushes out against the pumice, against the sidewalls, and then the juice runs out into your tray.
So a little bit different, like then the basket press, you're doing a vertical up and down, like a shear factor,
yep.
to kind of push the pumice and get the extract the juice. And here,
it's pushing out against the outer walls.
Right. So there's a vertical tube in the center that Colin's talking about that you've yeah he's kind of squeezing it. It's
yep.
just a bladder, and you fill it up with water, and it pushes out. Wow.
Yep.
What's the principle behind that?
Well, instead of using the claws and everything where you have to squeeze down and wash the claws, which is a major...
Yeah, a lot of labor.
This, I think, will be, unless we're in full production, and if it works good enough, I'm thinking about getting a second one and doing away with the cleanup on the claws.
Totally. Nice, nice.
And what Bill Dyer down there told me, he said, once you use it, you'll never go back. So this is the smallest one they make. We're going to try it. If it works, I think we're going to go to that.
Now, what is the size of that?
Four and a half bushels.
Four and a half bushels.
And they make them all the way up to, I think, the biggest one is like 12 or 13 bushel, but there's three or four sizes in between.
Yeah. I haven't seen one up close and personal like this, so I'm really excited to hear how you're going to...
Well, come back in November and I'll tell you.
Oh, yeah, I will. You know I will. But you still put... It looks like you're going to still put a bag in there, right?
Yep. Yep. You've got a bag in there that you use.
Yeah.
But that's a lot easier than trying to bleach cider claws and...
Yes, it is.
Keep them clean.
Yeah, yeah. How exciting.
I know the guys all laugh about going through washing machines one after another. So we'll see how this works.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's not...
No, that's okay.
Major production, but I think with two of them, especially if I get one of the bigger ones and keep them in rotation, because I can be filling one while the other one's pressing.
Right.
And then just keep swapping them.
Yeah. Yeah, there's on the side of this unit, there's a little place where you hook up your water. It's like a basic garden hose hookup.
Mm-hmm.
The nice thing about this is you're not cranking down, which takes a bit of physical strength. You're just letting the water do the cranking.
Yep. When you get done, there's a lever over here, you trip.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Somewhere here.
I think it's this thing here, the circular? No.
No, it's right here. Shows you how much I've run this.
Well, you'll be a pro.
Oh, here it is right here.
Okay.
It just tips the side
it.
And everything dumps all the pumps.
Oh, wow. You don't have to lift that up at all, which is another weighty thing.
Yep. And they actually make a grinder that has a conveyor that goes right in.
That's nice.
Yeah,
because lifting the pumice is heavy work, too.
Yeah.
How much does one of these go for?
That I'm not sure of.
Okay, all right. Well, people could look it up.
Yeah, no.
Get a photo of it.
Go on to Osco's site and or give them a call down there.
Yeah.
I think it was around 2,000.
Okay, and I think that's imported from overseas.
It is.
Yeah.
And they have to actually. Bill was telling me change the water hookup before they sell it.
Oh, because of what we have whatever.
Exactly. Yeah.
Standard. Cool.
So hopefully, if it works out, we'll be grinding cider in this and maybe filling people's barrels and that want it filled.
Nice. Good to know.
Yeah.
Very good to know. All right. I'm going to just turn this off for a little bit and then get my stuff and we'll kind of take two. Look at that little red field apple.
I got the grass, like I told you, from Dave Shearer, the science, and he said, I've never had an apple variety that grew as many apples consistently as a red field. He said they just, every year they set a heavy crop.
And they sure make a nice cider, too.
That's why he grows.
Yeah. I know, talking to Field Maloney, I had him on the podcast. He's like episode one, and I really wanted to have West County on there for, you know, all the obvious reasons. And we were talking about making cider with the Redfield apple, and he was saying it's kind of persnickety, though. So yeah. Don't be fooled by it. You know, it's a little persnickety, and he kind of got into it more. But I think it was his parents that brought over the original Scion. The Geneva. They went over there, Terry and Judith, and brought it back.
Yeah.
I love that. They're like the Johnny Appleseeds of modern day.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah, so all these apples out here, are you going to be selling these on cider days? I know that Lou and Sue do that too. Do you also do this at the site?
We've been selling them. Anybody that stopped in or showed any interest, we've sold them. The tall ones, like I told you, are mainly heirloom varieties. There's a little bit of everything mixed in there. Lou and Sue brought up a bunch of Scions, and Dave Shearer gave me a bunch. Anything that doesn't sell, we're putting a block up on the hill that's going to be a total cider production. So it'll be low maintenance. We don't care about the cosmetic of the apple.
Right. So. Let's come back out here in a little bit. Okay. We'll talk about it. There's a truck across the street doing a little bit of overhaul. Okay, great. Good.
As much noise out as we can.
Yeah. So, I'm going to just... Is there a place that we could kind of sit down? I see you got one chair, but even a apple crate would do, too.
You take the chair, and I'll take a bench. How's that?
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Oh, my good. And I know you are. Okay. All righty. So I'd like to start from the beginning a little bit.
Okay.
Because obviously you've been in this for a while.
My entire life.
Yeah. So how would you describe your job title, how does your family and friends know you as
that crazy guy that still keeps growing apples when he ought to give it up?
Of course.
Let's mom and dad started it in 1954. They both grew up on farms and that had apples and dairy cows. There happened to be an orchard up here that elderly man was getting ready to rent. So he stopped, saw Dad, and wanted to know if he wanted to rent it. Dad at that time was working construction, so he ran the apple orchard in between, mornings and nights. And Mom worked during the day on it. And then one of the other neighbors, the next year, wanted to know if he wanted to rent his apple orchard. So it kind of got into being a full-time occupation.
Wow.
And I've run it my entire life, I guess. So
you've been around apples for a long time.
Longer
and
than
peaches.
I should have been. And peaches, yeah. We grow a lot of peaches and nectarines and all the stone fruits.
Yeah. Peaches aren't easy to grow up here.
We're right on the northern limit of it.
Yeah.
We used to always figure if we could get them 4 out of 5 years, we were doing well up here.
4 out of 5 years.
Yeah. And they don't come in numerical order either, so... Sometimes you can lose them quite often.
Right. Interesting.
So, yeah, we kind of pieced together the farm. I'm still trying to add to it if I find something that helps.
Go ahead.
Right now we've got about, I've cut a lot of the blocks down. We're getting out of the wholesale market as much as we can.
So what have you been doing exactly all these years? What were your folks doing? And then what did you kind of come in and did you change any of that business model?
Yes. Ever since the 90s, once the Southern Hemisphere apples started coming in, imports from even other parts of the country, this area here grows a nice apple because of the hills and everything, but we're also, we don't have big orchards. You know, they're small blocks, they're hard to take care of.
Because of the hills?
Because of the hills. If you can get 5 or 10 acres, that's a good sized block of apple trees for you.
Yeah.
Whereas other parts of the country, they can put in
swaths.
Hundreds of acres.
Yeah.
You know, so the maintenance is easier.
But they just don't have the same kind of variety of apples at this point.
Right. I know. We in these hills up here grow a nice apple. It's a good hard apple.
Is that because of the soil?
Soil, altitude.
Mm-hmm. What does altitude have to do with growing apples?
You know, you get a harder apple the higher up you get until you get to a certain limit, and then it's too high for it.
Huh.
Right around 1,000 to 1,200 feet is nice.
Okay.
But the wholesale market is tougher for us because we can't grow that many apples, you know.
Not the quantity.
The quantity, right. So we've cut back. I'm down to about 20 acres of apples, probably 3 of stone fruit, and then some berries and other stuff to use at our roadside stand.
Mm-hmm.
And
most of the apples that you've been growing, I imagine your folks are growing, were eating apples.
Yes. Almost. When I was a kid, you grew a Macintosh. The rest of the varieties were pollinators for Macs, and mm-hmm. if you picked them okay, if you didn't, well, your money mm-hmm. was in your Macintosh.
Mm-hmm.
And now the stores don't want Macintosh the way they used to.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the hot craze for a long time has been Honeycrisp. A lot of guys went into it big. We probably didn't plant as many as we should have, looking back on it, but it looked like the market was going to get flooded.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like a poker game.
Oh, yeah. And it's not like a vegetable that you throw in the spring and harvest. You're talking a long-term investment.
Yeah.
With the dwarf trees, they've shortened the time it takes to get a full crop off them. But it's still a major investment in getting them in the ground.
Absolutely. So most of the trees that you have, are they dwarf or are they standard size?
No, I have probably 3 standard trees left on the entire farm. And that's just because...
you got to do what you got to do,
yeah,
right?
Well, I think it's more or less just... I haven't gotten around to cutting them down yet and replacing them. Mainly, we're in semi-dwarfs, but lately I've been going to more dwarfing rootstock. Economics forces you can't really afford to pay somebody to climb very high for apples.
Yeah.
The more you can pick from the ground or a short way up, the better.
It's safe.
It's safe.
Safer, yeah.
Yep. Dwarfing trees, of course, they control them by their root size, which makes them more sensitive to everything. They're more sensitive to drought, and they're just not as hardy a tree.
Mm-hmm.
The more you dwarf it, the weaker it is.
Mm. So what is the standard size of the dwarf trees that you're planting or have planted now?
Well, that...
Does that vary?
That varies. Of course, every variety of apple has different vigor.
Yeah.
A northern spy will grow twice as big as a Honeycrisp on the same rootstock. So what I try to do is match up the ones with more vigor with a more dwarfing rootstock to try to... what I'm aiming for is right around 10 to 12 feet height on my trees.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, our ladders were all 24 feet long.
Wow.
Because, you know, that's how you grew.
That's climbing up the side of a house.
Exactly. Well,
wow.
A lot of times you went the first 10 feet before you hit an apple. You know, the trees were 80 years old and planted 40 by 40. But that's production. Dad laughs about it. When the first semi-dwarf rootstocks came out, nobody trusted them. So they'd put in a standard in the normal 40, and then they'd put a semi-dwarf in between. And the idea was if the semi-dwarf didn't make it, they'd still have the standards. And if the semi-dwarf did, they'd cut the standard and put another semi-dwarf in its place. But nobody ever did. You just lived with what you did. So
Yeah. Wow, you live and you learn.
Yeah.
I was wondering about the apple market all those years, how the price has fluctuated.
Well, I think of course, we're probably getting more per bushel, but the profit margin keeps shrinking. It's supply and demand.
Yeah.
If you're able to get as many apples as you want, you can pay less for them. Back 50 years ago, a lot of our apples, well, I remember as a kid, went down to Florida to Winn-Dixie because mm-hmm. all the retirees...
Winn-Dixie, is that like the...
The chain store.
The chain store, that's what I thought you meant, yeah?
Yeah, a lot of the people who had retired from New England and Michigan moved down, and they wanted a good hard Macintosh to eat down there in Florida, so we'd ship them down. And
just to Winn-Dixie?
Well, that was one of the markets.
Wow.
Yeah. We actually shipped Macintosh around the world because we used to sell it to J.P. Sullivan out of Air Mass. They were a big distributor.
Okay.
And they had a big market in the United Kingdom. And they also had that one down there in Winn-Dixie.
Wow.
So...
Are you still shipping?
No.
No. So where is your market now?
It's in Boston at Chelsea Marketplace.
Okay, yeah.
I have a wholesaler down there that handles my apples.
Nice.
But it's, there again, I'm competing with a lot of bigger growers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't have the land. I don't have the means to grow an apple as cheap as they can.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it would seem like with the growing interest in apple, and you know, certainly I think cider is kind of the apple's best friend right now.
Mm-hmm.
Although the orchardists like yourself, you're looking at, well, what do I do now? You know, there's this are the orchardists convinced, or somebody like yourself convinced enough that, hell yeah, I'm going to start planting cider apples?
There, I got them ready to go.
I know you got them right out there. When did that kind of shift for you?
Well, probably in the last 10 years, I've noticed I've had people calling from all around looking whether I had any Baldwin apples. Mm. Now, we used to grow a lot of Baldwin apples, but we cut them all down because you couldn't sell them. Or they wanted to know whether I had any of the odd varieties at all. And being a little slow, it took me a while, but it finally dawned on me, well, people are calling looking for them. Maybe I better grow them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it is, it's a new niche that hopefully will work out.
Yeah.
And you have to have it. You're either going to find something like that or you're not going to survive in today's
market. You got to keep on being flexible.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in any business, of course.
Any business.
Why would it be any different here?
Yep.
Yeah, so that's interesting. What's the furthest out call that you've gotten for?
I know I've had people from Vermont, and I had one guy from Connecticut come up and actually get apples looking for them.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, especially with cider days. Just right here, you're in the hub of cider days. Imagine that is a pretty good market. During cider days, I just want to get back to that. Are you actually open selling your...
Well, you know, we've never done anything other than Lou and Sue have come up and got apples from us and also trees to sell down there.
Yeah.
They didn't have enough.
Right.
I think at some point we'll probably have to get involved in it. We're a small family operation. It's my wife and I, and we have a couple of neighbors that come and help us out. So that time of year, normally we're stretched pretty thin. I think probably it would pay to make time for those few days.
Well, maybe we'll talk a little bit off mic about that.
Yeah.
But certainly we'll be reminding listeners to maybe call you or contact if they're coming up to cider days. I know that Lou and Sue always sells out of the trees that they bring down there. And so if folks know ahead of time, then they can make the plans for that.
Right.
For sure.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of curious. I want to go back to just the growing of the apples. Because when I met you just a couple weeks ago, you were talking about the grafting and the different rootstock. And I'd like to understand more about that. Because there's... the dwarf sizes and different, you know, people say M1118 or all that. What does that stand for? And how do you, like, figure that out? Because a lot of the folks that are listening to this will be cider makers, you know, maybe wanting to, like, plant a larger orchard. But there are a lot of folks just like myself who want to have a dandy little, you know, small orchard in their yard and are always on the lookout for that kind of wiggy little variety.
Right.
So what do you look for?
Well, let's start right at the beginning. The whole idea behind grafting is to take the variety you want and put it on the rootstock you want. And as we were talking, the vigor of the variety contributes also to the size of the tree. So there's a lot of information out there. People go on you talked about the MM, the mauling rootstocks, mm-hmm. and they go the 9s up to the 26s to the 7s to the 111s to 118s, each one getting gradually bigger.
And what does that mean?
Well, they normally tell you a percentage, like a 26, they'll tell you 30 to 40%. And that's the size of a standard tree. So it gets to be, if you put a Macintosh on a standard tree and one on a 26, it would be 30 to 40% of the size of the standard one.
Oh, okay.
Whereas a 118 or a 111 are going to be 60 to 70% the size. So they're going to be almost as big. So
what the, it doesn't really correlate to the 18 being 18%. Are those numbers just like what the scientists picked out?
I think somebody grabbed in a hat and grabbed the number and started with it.
It would have helped if they did that a little bit differently.
Well, that's...
From my mind.
Right now, I'm actually switching over to a lot of the Geneva rootstocks.
Geneva rootstock, that it came out of Geneva?
Yes, Geneva. Okay. And Cummings, I think, was the guy's name who did a lot of the research there. He wanted a rootstock that was more resistant to fire blight, which is becoming an issue to orchards around.
So let's talk first about fire blight and exactly what that is.
It's a bacteria, and it attacks the cell walls of the tree, and it will kill a tree. Everybody's lost. Matter of fact, I've heard horror stories where guys have lost a third or half of their apple trees in 1 year.
What does it look like on a tree initially?
Well,
how does it progress?
It'll start on the tips, and you'll see the leaf begin to curl, and it'll just run right down the thing and right towards the trunk. And we have some sprays that we can use, some of the streptomycins. I try to do a good copper spray in dormancy just to get rid of any of the fire blight knockout that I can, but it's still there.
Mm. A big problem.
It's a big problem. And some varieties are more sensitive than others. Some rootstocks are more sensitive than others. So by switching to the Geneva ones, I'm hoping to get away with some of those problems. May not cure it totally, but you use every arrow in your quiver that you can.
Well said. So, yeah.
So getting back to the Geneva rootstocks, they're a whole new set of numbers which don't correlate to anything other than you have to look them up and know what they are.
Yeah.
The ones I've got out here in the buckets are mainly 41, Geneva 41, and also Geneva 935, and they'll be 30 to 40% of a standard tree.
Okay.
So like I said, by matching the variety to the rootstock, I'm hoping to keep them around 10 to 12 feet tall.
Which is a doable size.
A doable height.
Yeah,
That's not a bad height to work with.
Yeah.
So
the type of graft that you're doing onto that rootstock, what's the name of that graft?
Most of those are bench grafted. Mm-hmm. I like to start with the bench grafting because I can do it in March when I have a little spare time. If we've got a lousy day, it's nice to come in here when it's snowing and raining out and work for a few hours bench grafting. Plus, by doing it that early, it gives me a second shot at regrafting anything that didn't take because I can bud graft this time of year. Last year, I had, I think, 15 or 20 that didn't take, so a week or so ago, I bud grafted them.
Mm. How are they doing?
They look good so far. I'll tell you better next spring.
Yeah.
That's bench grafting. Of course, you do it when they're dormant, and it's almost an immediate response to them. Where bud grafting, it'll be pretty much next spring, whether before I know they're going to take or not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So with that graft, what are you know? I've used a couple different, I don't know, the putty, and then there's the really really sticky stuff, and that's what I've actually been using. That's super sticky.
Yeah. Is it a wax that you're using?
I guess. I got it from Conway, Wesco. And folks say, well, and talking to Sue Chadwick, she said, well, that's really the better stuff to use versus the stuff that doesn't really quite stick to your hand. But I'll tell you, that's a bugger to work with.
Yeah, no, that wax. Put a little Vaseline on your hand.
On your hand, and that helps. Well, in hindsight.
I actually, for bench grafting, I use, it's a stretchy tape. plastic tape.
Yeah, clear.
Clear.
Yeah, clear, yeah.
And, white. You know, when I first started bench grafting more years ago than I'd like to admit to, it used to look like masking tape. And you really had to wax over that because it would dry out. Grafting, the secret to grafting is lining up the cambium layers, getting it airtight so it doesn't dry out. And if you do those two things, they almost always take.
Isn't it also a little bit of timing, too?
Well, timing on, yes.
The Scion, you know, I mean, folks are, you know, shooting up to Maine from, we're in Massachusetts right now, shooting up to Maine to, like, a Super Chili Farm with John Bunker and that team up there, and then bringing it down, and they might not be grafting it for, like, a week or two later.
And that's the other secret. I've had people give me Scion wood, and they let it dry out a little bit. If it dries out, it won't take either. Mm-hmm. You've got to. I like to keep it wrapped in wet newspaper,
mm-hmm.
and keep it in a cooler with an ice block in there.
That's
keep
all.
It moist
yeah.
all the time.
Spray it.
Yep.
Yeah. Spray the wet the newspaper.
Wet the newspaper. Yeah. Yeah. They don't want to be in standing water, but keep it moist
yeah.
all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if I've got a choice, I'll go out and cut it fresh and use it right then.
Yeah.
I'll cut what I'm going to use in the morning, then go back after lunch and mm-hmm. cut a new batch.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think it makes a big difference.
Yeah, so you're using that nice, because that's the tape that I use right now,
yep.
too. You're using that same kind of like really sticky, resin-y? With a...
No, well, let me get my grafting box out.
Yeah, I'll be kind of curious. I always like these little tips because, to tell you the truth, I just did my first graft this year after visiting Lou and Sue.
Yeah.
And I can't believe it, but that some of them took.
Good.
Which I felt like I had a lot of good luck there.
Well, sometimes it's better to be lucky than good.
That's true. Yeah.
That's a tool I use.
Okay, yeah, yeah. I've seen that. That's, again, from OSCO.
Yeah.
And that...
You just...
I'm going to get a photo of that, too.
Okay. Makes a U-cut in the wood. If I had a stick of wood, well, you've done it.
Right. I'm just using a knife because I do the rind graft, and I just kind of like sliver it off on either side, and that seems to do it pretty well for me.
Yep. The big thing about bench grafting is, like I said, matching up the cambium layers. So if you got the same size Scion that you're using on the rootstock, that's... I'll look through a dozen of them to find one that, and if
the right
it's not
size.
Close, I'll go find another one.
Yeah.
Because if they don't match up really good, they're not going to take.
You're not going to get it. Yeah. Well, it seems like it's an easy jigsaw puzzle to do, but
right.
You know, it's always something new there.
Is it the tape you use?
Yep, that's exactly the tape
yep.
I use. Right, let me just put down this little microphone here.
Yep.
See if I can find my.
The secret to that tape is you can almost feel it stretch. And that,
yes.
You want to,
yeah.
And you get that stretch to it all the time, and it'll make a nice tight seal.
It kind of all reminds me a little bit like beekeeping a bit, too. You know, you have to, like, be in a certain meditative form
right.
to do this work. You can't just be...
No, it's not production. You have to...
Yeah. Really think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the focus. All right. There we are. That's a great little tool.
Yeah.
Especially if you're doing high production.
Yeah. Somewhere in here I've got... There's Dad's grafting stuff right there. That's what he used.
Oh, no
he did
kidding.
A lot of Scion grafting. I don't even
no
want to know
kidding.
How old that stuff is. Probably something his dad gave him.
I'll just move this back
okay,
here. Get
yeah.
a little bit of light here. Wow. So that's a little wooden...
Yeah, that was
put that against a...
And then something, I don't know whether they made it.
That's a cool little tool that was definitely.
To Scion graft, you put that on top of the stump, you give it a wrap, you turn it around, put that in the middle and wrap it, and it holds it open. You put your Scions in and take it out.
Wow.
So.
That's a nice all-in-one tool.
Yeah, I would say that's handmade looking at it.
I would totally say that's handmade.
So,
yeah.
No, we've come a ways since.
We have come a ways,
although
but
I still Scion graft. I still
I bet
use
you do,
it.
Yeah.
But if I'm top grafting trees, I like to bark graft more than I do Scion
mm-hmm,
graft.
Mm-hmm.
I can do it quicker, and I think I get a better rate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. great. Very cool. And you have a nice little metal box here with all the rest of your tools, little hammers. And
there's the wax.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice.
So.
Yeah. Got to keep it all together because you're
coming
that season.
For it, yeah.
You don't want to be running around like chicken with your head cut off.
Well, even with the box, that's not a guarantee.
It happens, right?
That's right.
So you're doing the orchard planting and all that. You must be doing the pruning too.
Yes, we do all our own. I do all the pruning. Yeah.
Ah, so I'd like to. I don't know if it's kind of easy to talk to you a little bit about pruning, standing inside a building.
Well.
But I'm kind of curious about that.
Well, I think there's some basics to pruning, and after that, it's more art than science because no two people prune the same. I mean, I learned from my father, we could be in the same tree, and he'd say, well, aren't you going to cut that? I'd say, no, but aren't you going to cut that? There's main things you're looking for, good crotch angles.
The people who say you would want to, like, throw a cow through it, that's how they used to.
Yeah.
Large enough, an opening in the tree to have a cow go through it, but now that's kind of changed.
Well, it has, and... you're just looking for good light penetration to get in because light is so crucial to growing apples. These new plantings that they're doing on the wires, the high density.
A spalia?
Yes.
Yes. Like a flat wire?
They're looking for 80 to 90% light penetration down in on that tree.
Yeah.
Because you can't grow apples without light. They just won't grow in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why on a tree, if you get that big canopy, that's where you're going to grow your apples. And then the rest is just going to be wood in there.
Well, there's some trees that you see where folks are almost making it like a crew cut top.
Mm-hmm. I've done that.
Yeah.
They call that an open vase. And I think it makes it easier. You've got that whole surface. It's all there to grow on. Instead of using the central leader system, what I normally do is, as a tree grows, I grow a central leader system. And then at some point I may decide to make it a modified one and trim the two laterals and keep it to a certain height if they're going to grow too tall. And then as it gets even larger and I start losing that light penetration, I'm apt to go to an open center and make a big cut right in the center.
Right in the center. So you're cutting down into that notch a little bit.
Yeah, I'm cutting right at the laterals that I want to keep on a flat there.
Yeah.
And I may grow another central leader to start to get fresh wood up in there. Mm-hmm. Or I may, depending on the variety, keep it as an open center.
Hmm.
I found Macowans, I can do a nice job growing them on an open center because they're a spur type and they like to grow on that upright wood.
Interesting. Now, someone like myself, I have a couple of apple trees that might be volunteers. I have a kind of an old homestead, basically. And so I've been slowly discovering, both on my side of the road and my neighbor's side of the road, that there's some hidden apple trees.
Yep.
And they could be any age, because they just might have been sitting dormant there. And they're not really big. And now they're starting to get some light, because I've been clearing out and they're getting happy. But how do you approach like an old tree? Because I know a lot of listeners have these trees. They're like, oh, I just bought a house and there's an apple tree and it's just been going crazy for years.
Well, I think you got the right idea. The first thing is to open up the woods around them and get sunlight in there. The first year, I wouldn't even trim them after I did that because it's going to be quite a shock to the tree all
getting
of a sudden
sunlight.
To go from the shade to sunlight. After that, I do it in stages. Over a three-year period, make a few cuts, let a little light down in there, see if you can get some regrowth down in, because most of them look like a mushroom. They just grow that top and everything shades out underneath.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can get some new growth down in there. Sometimes you can't.
Okay.
So
you want, if you're getting a lot of, just on my drive here today, I looked at this one apple tree, and I'm thinking, dang, I really want to trim that apple out. So we're getting like a lower sucker that's coming out.
Mm-hmm.
I would keep that there and kind of foster it
along.
You
can. That's actually a good way to start a whole new
central leader.
Yeah.
If you've got a limb coming off in the trunk and you get a nice sucker growing up,
yeah,
that can be your whole tree right there.
Right there. As yep. the crown, some of the crown ones are kind of dying back just because it's been neglected and there's been vines. So cutting that back is a good way to go.
Yeah. Let some light penetrate down in there, see what you got, and work from that. Every tree is different. You kind of have to step back and take a look at it and say, well, this is what we've got to work with.
Right, they have a personality of their own.
Everyone does.
I love that.
There's no science to it, really.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the basics. You try to get rid of the bad angle crotches. You try to let light down in. You've got to be able to get a ladder in there for people. Containment, if you're planting, you know, and trying to get through to mow and spray and stuff, you've got to contain them back a little bit.
So contain it, like if they're kind of hanging way over, it could be a little hard to mow them. So do you cut that and trim it out so you could walk underneath it?
Well, not so you can walk underneath it, but so that,
get under, into it
so I can get the machinery through.
All right.
A lot of times what you'll notice is once the branch starts hanging down, a new one will sprout.
Yes.
And you can either, you know, make a few cuts or you can take it right off at that sprout and that'll be your new
limb.
And
let it go there. Yeah.
But every variety is different. I trim a Macallan different than I do a tip bearer like a Cortland, you know. Macallans, you can hold them back a little more. Cortlands, you've got to have that fruit growing right at the end of their growth. So you have to trim them differently.
And are you seeing anything with those cider varieties? Because the Macallan and the Cortland aren't necessarily cider varieties
in
my mind.
Too early to tell on the cider variety. Some of them I know, Northern Spies and the Greenings we've had for years. I know how to control them. Some of the other ones that I'm just starting with, that'll be a learning curve that I'll just have to figure out. Yeah.
Now, how about just maintenance over the course of the year for nutrients and all that? You know, they say like a cider apple, you really want kind of low nutrient.
Right.
So do you just...
I think even on a cider variety, though, you've got to deal with tree health. Any plant or tree, you've got to get it as healthy as you can to not only produce the fruit, but also fight off diseases and insects and everything else.
Are you doing integrated pest management?
We've done that for years. Nobody wants to spend any more on spray material than they absolutely have
or
to.
Or the time.
So every corner you can cut, you do.
Yeah.
My block of cider apples that I put in, like I said, will be mainly for tree health that I do. It won't have anything to do with cosmetics. So in other words, like right now I'm worried about sooty blotch on my apples and fly specks, which is just a fungus that
grows on the actual apple itself.
And it doesn't hurt it, but it just doesn't look good enough, so we have to throw it out. So I have to spray for that. My cider varieties,
you don't have to worry
about it.
Yeah. No. It's kind of a nice low maintenance for an orchardist.
Well, it is. It'll be quite a bit lower, But I'm still, I want to make sure the trees are as healthy as I possibly can get them. We've gone to, in the last few years, more and more into foliar nutrients, especially after last year. You know, the fertilizer I put out just stayed there. We never had any rain all summer.
Yeah.
Trees were stressed, but they were able to absorb the foliar nutrients that I gave them. And this year, I went even more, a more in-depth plan. I sat down with my fertilizer salesman, and she went through the whole thing, and we set up a program. We do soil and leaf analysis. Well, we do soil every year and leaf every third year about.
So, and you're sending that out to a lab?
It goes down to UMass,
tested,
and then I get the results back, and we can look, and it may tell me my potassium's low, or it may tell me my lime is low. Things like that. We try to make it ideal for the tree. Whatever it needs, it has.
Nice. Yeah, that's a good tip if you have a local university.
I think that's money well spent, anybody trying to grow any amount of apples. Tree health, it's going to only help your tree that much more.
So get your soil tested.
Yeah.
And do a leaf test. And what time of year do you do
the
leaf test?
Leaf test you normally do, well, it's just about this time of year, about the 1st of August. And that lets you know not what's in the soil, but what the tree's able to get. Because so many of the nutrients, it can be in the soil, but if for some reason there's not
something out of balance, the tree can't take it up. And so you can be putting fertilizer down, but if your lime's off, it's not able to use those.
Yeah, interesting, yeah.
And I think even for cider varieties, you want that tree healthy.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you want to have that fruit as much as possible. Have a good concentration of
the sugars.
Sugar. Big thing there. Neat. Well, that's a lot of good information for all of us to kind of sit on and muster through. It's so exciting what you're doing here. And I think what's really exciting is that you've been doing this as part of your family's trade, Scott's Farm. You know, really, this wealth of knowledge that you have is just it's just invaluable. And I thank you for being that kind of like steward of the apple trees for all these years.
I always say my dad always forgot more about growing apples than I'll probably ever know, but he did pass some of it along to me, so.
Well, why don't we give your dad's full name and your mom's full name?
Okay, it was Edward and Janice Scott, and they grew up in Asheville and moved here to Buckland, or actually they lived in Asheville and just had the farm in Buckland.
Nice. Wow. So, that's a good good ancestry there. You know, it's really what it's all about in these hill towns is kind of passing that along. And with so many new folks coming in and the excitement around cider, I'm wondering if you are open to folks contacting you as they're coming up. And
Any questions, I'll try to answer. You know, the extension service probably can give you a more. Sometimes it's not bad to go to somebody who's done it instead of just researched it.
Absolutely. Nothing like that. You can't grow corn out of a book,
exactly.
What I like to say. You got to put it in the ground and then start talking.
That's another piece of wisdom my father told me years ago. He says, listen to what they say, but make your own decision. Because he says, they get a paycheck every 2 weeks. You don't. So it's still your final decision, no matter what the extension service tells you.
That's right. Absolutely. Well, this is wonderful. I so appreciate your time talking to us.
No problem. I'm glad to talk with you. It's always good to find somebody who's enthusiastic about it.
And you know what?
For me, it's just a daily job.
But you're still passionate about it. So I look forward to kind of staying in touch a little bit because how that press works. I'm really curious about that.
You know what? If you would like to, once we get it set up, you can even come up and grind some and press it. We'll let you do that.
Okay, good.
Day after day, if you'd like.
A special time to be able to sit back in the apple storage center of E and J Scott Orchard. Did you catch that? The E is for Edward and the J for Janice. Ah, that is just like some family history there. I think, kind of brings like a little bit of a tear to my eye, but pretty sweet. And what a sweet man. And he is just a bushel load of information. To be able to talk about pruning, you know, I said, can we do that inside? He was like, well, somebody like that, you know, he can. Really educator and an absolute treasure, an American treasure in that way. I know there's a lot of folks out there, and I just feel really privileged that I got to spend some time with Colin that day. And I think how he ended this chat was rather informative and something to think about that. You know, sometimes you do have to seek out those folks who have it, in addition to going to the extension services. But the idea that, you know, people working on university, they're getting that paycheck every week or 2 weeks probably. And those of you out there who are doing this commercially or putting every kind of little penny you can to move up to that kind of level, you're not. So you have to take everything with a little bit of grain of salt and then in the end make your own decision. And it takes a little bit of kind of apple courage, so to speak, to be able to do this type of work. And I think it gives us a really good perspective, the work that it takes to bring that apple to the glass. It's not as simple as it looks sometimes, is it? And even though he's kind of like in the business of culinary apples primarily, he is certainly kind of watching from that kind of typical New England traditional eye, being a little wary as a farmer. But I think if we keep on reaching out to him, that we might get this guy to like start going in that direction a little bit further. I have a feeling that some of the information I'm going to put up on this website here at ciderchat.com for this here episode number 93 is going to maybe make Colin and Laura a little bit busy. So I'll be managing that. I'm just right now going to post the email, and then for folks who are really serious, you could contact me directly or via their email and get the actual phone number so it's not ringing off the hook. All right, a little break here and we'll be right back. Next week on episode 94, I will be chatting about palms in art, which is a little sidebar that I'll be including into the podcast on a weekly basis, a little piece on art in terms of palms. So we'll be looking at Renoir and his still life with apples and pears. So essentially not only looking at the liquid form every week in terms of cider and perry, but also on the physical form. And in this terms, it's going to be a painting. So I'm really stoked about that. And I'm also really thrilled that Kurt just signed up to become a patron of Cider Chat. Kurt came in at the $3 level, so that's $3 a month, which I would hope is kind of doable for most folks. If it's not, then hey, don't even think about becoming a patron. I get it. But if you could do something at that level or greater, it would help this podcast quite a bit. So thank you very much, Kurt. Thanks for joining in, becoming a patron, and also a big thanks to all the folks who are currently patrons and the commercial cideries, such as Current Cider of Apercosy, Pennsylvania, Big Fish Cider Company in Monterey, Virginia, and Ramborn Cider Company in Luxembourg. That's the country of Luxembourg. If you are a commercial cidery interested in joining the Cider Going Up campaign page, just go to ciderchat.com and you'll find the info there. In the meanwhile, I'm going to get ready for episode number 94. Ooh, 94. That's pretty close to 100, isn't it? We're having a good time in Ciderville, and that's all right by me. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Yeehaw!